It's 11:53 p.m. on a McNugget body pillow, and you're listening to Night Call. Hello, and welcome to Night Call, a call-in show for our dystopian reality. My name is Emily Ishida, and with me on the other line, as always, are
Molly Lambert and
Tess Lynch.
And we're going to be joined later in the show by Justin Charity from The Ringer to talk about anime, Travis Scott, QAnon Twitter, but not actively participating in it, and a lot of other stuff. It's a wide-ranging conversation, so stay tuned for that. We have a night call that we want to take right now from the happiest place on earth. Shall we roll it?
Hey, night call. Long time, first time. I'm just calling to tell you the story of how I went to Disney World recently. I live in Florida, and I was visiting some family up in the Orlando area. And I wasn't planning on going to the parks at all. I've been pretty, as far as erring on the side of caution goes, I've been pretty extreme in terms of not leaving my house for the most part. Rationally so, I think. I'm not like agoraphobic or anything like that. But so I get there to visit family, and they basically are like, so there's this Florida resident discount right now. Tickets are really cheap. We won't bring this up to the kids as a possibility until we talk to you. We'll all go, but only if you want to go. And I don't know, in like some sort of lapse of judgment or feeling like outnumbered, or you know, that feeling of like, well, all of these people think it's a good idea. I guess maybe I'm being, you know, extreme or something. So I went and had a pretty good time. All of the lines are 6 feet apart. There's like hand sanitizers everywhere. There's like plexiglass in between line formations, so you're not like breathing on everybody as you're waiting in line. And most of the lines have been moved outside, but none of that really changes the fact that like a lot of rides are inside and you're just fucking touching a lot of stuff. And there's like so many different vectors of transmission at a park that like even at 25% capacity, which I think they're holding it to, it's still like a lot of people in and out. So I like went to the parks over the weekend, and then last night I like kind of woke up in the middle of the night having a hard time sleeping, and then just sort of in that like middle of the night fashion started thinking about like all of the different ways we could have gotten COVID by going to the parks, and how, you know, temperature checks only cover people who are like symptomatically sick and not those who are asymptomatic, and you know, how many things we had to have touched. Anyway, bottom line is I woke up in the middle of the night last night and had a full-blown anxiety attack, which is actually the first one I've experienced throughout quarantine, probably because up until this point I've been extremely cautious, and then I was feeling like I threw all of that away by going to the parks this weekend. You know, wanted to give you an insider report of Disney World, which is like a fucking surreal right now, and just like wild to be there while everybody's like wearing masks. You know, it feels super weird. But also to give all of your listeners a warning that, you know, if you're considering doing something, like if you're maybe feeling like, well, maybe everything is like safer out there than I think it is, or you're kind of double guessing the way that you've approached quarantining and being safe up until now, and like feeling like you're being left out of stuff because like things are reopening and people are going out to eat and shit. I was feeling fine while I was there, and then it all just hit me when I got home and realized it was a terrible decision. So I would recommend not going overall. And I would also especially recommend not going if you're prone to anxiety attacks, because this was the worst one that I've had in a long time. Thanks, Night Call. Have a good one.
Thank you so much for that call. That is definitely good advice to heed, to be more cautious than it seems like when you look at the rest of the world and you see how people are starting to be a little bit less careful. I think it can make you feel as though you're being overly vigilant by continuing to quarantine. I guess it depends on how, on where you're located. But I was curious if you guys, Molly and Emily, have felt like, looking at, you know, how other people are operating at this stage of quarantine, that you feel like there's a disconnect there.
I think that people have gotten really cooped up because we've been in quarantine for so long, and especially with the fires in California and Oregon, it has like doubled down on those feelings of claustrophobia and cabin fever. So I definitely, over the past like few days, was just like, had this urge to get out in the world just desperately because I could not. And I think a lot of people, because they've been holding back, then when they decide to do something, it is this sort of like liberating moment followed immediately by intense guilt and shame. My mom has some friends who, it's like they're very careful, but especially because they're older. And then it's like they'll go to Burger King to get some food and then just like have an anxiety attack of like, what if I just fucked myself over by going to Burger King? What if I now get COVID from this? Like, it's not worth it.
I'm kind of two minds. I think that there is definitely stuff that I am still, there's no way I'm going to do it. And I kind of look down upon people who do it. You know, I'm in a college town right now, and like college bar culture is just full steam ahead here. And that is, you know, obviously college age people aren't necessarily going to be symptomatic or really, you know, have a extreme case of COVID if they transmit it or if they get it. But, you know, it affects the rest of the community eventually in some way. And that, you know, it's hard for me to be like, oh, you know, they just, you know, we have to continue with life. I will say, though, that like, I do think that kind of that shame and the guilt feeling about doing something like going to a McDonald's or a Burger King or whatever, I don't feel at all anymore. I have to say, like going to a Burger King or something, it's like, that's not going to be, I don't think, how you contract COVID, unless you are immunocompromised, in which case, you know, all like the caller said, all of this stuff applies doubly. But there was just this article that came out, was on Elemental, which is like a Medium blog, like a science and health blog. It was trending all day yesterday, but it was sort of this most recent collection of findings about COVID and like, you know, how much they differ from what was being reported early on about how, you know, how it would spread, how you need to protect yourself and all of that. And the big thing from it is that like the surfaces thing, which is a lot of what the caller was calling about, is not really necessarily the biggest risk factor. And the way that they were conducting the studies early on is not really an accurate representation of how like the pathogens would be spread, the concentration they would be spread in. Just like being able to really concentrate on not like on the droplets thing, on just like not being in close quarters with people who you're not in a pod with. That's all pretty controllable. I feel like, I don't know, maybe it's because I've been out in the world for a while now, but I feel like I know exactly like what I can and can't do. And so like going to a get pickup from somewhere or get fast food or something like that is not necessarily the stuff that I'm feeling guilty or anxiety ridden about. I don't know.
Okay, but what about going to Disney World?
Well, that is your own.
I have to say, though, that I was so judgmental at the, honestly, the first like 3 months of quarantine. I had very strong reactions about how I felt other people were operating. And now that it's been this long, I'm trying to not do that. And I think like the thing with Disney, I don't feel as though you should feel guilt or shame about doing that, because you obviously made a call that you later realized was the wrong call. And it's not the same. The only people I really judge or think should feel shame are the people who are like anti-maskers, who are going around without a mask to basically be dicks and make a point.
Yeah.
I think that it's worth forgiving yourself for going to Disney. I I guess maybe 2 months ago, or maybe three, went, there was a socially distanced, like six of us were going to have a glass of wine for someone's like birthday. And I went up the street, it was just my neighbors, and I wore a mask, and then I sat down, and we were all far apart. We were outside, and because we were eating and drinking, I took down my mask. Everyone took down their masks.
Sure.
And it felt like, I was like, I'm not super comfortable with this, but I don't want to be wearing a mask and make them feel bad. And then on the walk home, my heart just started racing, and I was like, I'm not comfortable with the fact that I did that. And it, and not to judge anyone who is, who's going out to eat or whatever. I do think that that can put wait staff in a very uncomfortable position, which we've talked about before. And I think it might be like, I might consider it a little selfish, but I'm not going to really judge people for doing it. But there's this sense of like, you, like the caller said, where you don't want to compromise someone else's decision to like bring their kid to Disney, and they're taking these safety protocols or whatever. You don't want to be the one who brings everyone down. And it's only after you do it that you're like, oh shit, I made a mistake. And I think as long as you realize, like, as long as you check yourself and you think like, you know, I won't do that again, I'm going to be more careful, then there's no sense in really beating yourself up too much over it, you know?
I mean, Captain Bring Down over here, but I'll judge people for doing stuff that is overly risky and frivolous, I think.
But if it's a mistake, like if they're like, oh shit, I shouldn't have done it, you know?
No, I mean, I think going to Disney World because you get pressured into it and then feeling stressed out afterwards is, you know, completely understandable. I don't think this person was like...
But going to Disneyland takes a lot more steps and planning and consideration than having a glass of wine with your friends in a distance hang in somebody's backyard. Like,
yeah, that's true. But if everyone's saying, well, here's what they're doing. It's 25% capacity. Almost everything is outside. When she walked through the things that they were doing to keep people safe, I could see there being this like sliding doors thing where you're like, I know I should say no, but I'm trying to like make a reasonable leap that that's enough, that that's okay. And I think that those weird, you can make a judgment that rationally you wouldn't think you would make when you're just like, well, they're doing this and they're doing this and they're doing this. Like, I don't know, you know, nobody knows anything is the problem. And I do think you can judge people for, I mean, clearly, like, people are still having gender reveal parties and setting everything on fire. I surely judge those people. I judge mm-hmm. people who are having big parties. I judge people who are doing things deliberately. But I feel like everyone's had a moment where they just made the wrong call, you know?
Yeah, that's true, for sure. I mean, it's just, again, it's just like all a matter of what qualifies as dangerous or risky to you. And I think that that is, and that has been the theme throughout the last half year, is different at everybody at different moments. And what feels to you is completely reasonable and safe and rational to somebody else, maybe because they haven't read the same articles as you or whatever, like, will seem like a major risk and super inconsiderate and a horrible thing to do. And we're all living in different, like, at different stages of this, like, understanding and reality of like what this pandemic is. And a lot of us are, I don't know, I feel like I'm probably living in a place right now with it that a lot of people were living in with it a couple months ago. I've kind of relaxed to a point that I feel comfortable with it. Whereas like, there were a lot of people who were, I don't know, hanging out with friends on their porch or something. And I was like, oh God, you can't do that. But now I'm just like, whatever. Like, I don't feel like judgmental about it at all. And I would do it if anybody would have me. You know, I don't know.
I don't judge people for hanging out on their porches or for hanging out with friends in a group casually in a pod. I do think the normalization of eating at restaurants has been
agreed.
Completely
Do you guys know people who are eating at restaurants? That's the one thing where I'm like, no way, no way. Are you kidding me? Like,
I was walking the other day to get pickup, and I passed a restaurant that has been operating on Vermont in Los Feliz with plexiglass, you know, walls up between tables and stuff. And I saw I saw a couple that I know eating there, and I was like, man,
it just doesn't look fun. First and foremost, it doesn't look fun. It looks like really, like, aside from the actual risk involved, the plexiglass thing, the entire aesthetics of it, the everybody wearing masks around it while you're trying to eat food, it's just not fun looking at all.
It doesn't seem fun. I get stressed out by the fact that people have such, like, entitlement about being served by servers, because that's totally who's really at risk.
That's what you're servers there for.
Yeah.
Or to be out of the house, I guess. But you can be out of the house.
But you could be out of the house. You could have a picnic. It's like the insistence on being served by service workers, and the fact that that's who's really at risk are the service workers who have to deal with hundreds of people every day. Again, I'm not necessarily putting the blame on individuals who are like, ooh, I'd like to have a nice dinner out. I'm putting the blame on all the people who reopened early, especially now in LA. We have this al fresco bullshit program where they put tables on the sidewalk that they're now running out of money for. Where again, I'm like, well, why didn't they just take that money and give it to restaurants to shut down and pay their staff?
I completely agree with that. I think it's a great distinction, Molly, to say that I don't understand why people want to eat at restaurants right now. Shaming them individually when they've been told that the measures that are in place are relatively safe. Like, it's a weird thing to want to have dinner out when you know that you're making a person who works there, like, face the risk of you contaminating them. But it's also hard to not say, well, that's not like a personal flaw on their part necessarily. It's a weird call, but it's a flaw. It's a systemic flaw.
I think it's also that thing of the future being here and distributed unevenly, where because coronavirus has been dealt with in a better way in other places, and because of social media, it's like people see that people in other countries are back to normal more or less in certain ways. And they're like, well, why can't I do that? You know, I think in LA, some of the feelings I have about people eating in restaurants in New York, I have to remind myself, like, well, they're down to like a 1% transmission rate versus Los Angeles, which is not. So it is different.
Yeah.
Yeah. This is like an early problem, I think, with the coverage of the disease and so much of it being focused on New York, probably because a lot of media is based in New York. And this is an ongoing thing we almost contend with, is that like the reality of COVID in New York was not what it was in the rest of the country at that time. And then I think that a lot of people, like, the measures that were being taken in certain places were like New York measures a lot of times, and now people are still in the New York reality of stuff when, like, New York is not there anymore. And yeah, it's like everybody's kind of cycling through this stuff at different times, and it just makes it's hard to know where you stand in that.
This was also the most dystopian week because the air quality is so bad. It's like, you know, unbreathable essentially. And I just went out for a drive because I was feeling so claustrophobic, and all of the outdoor patios were packed. I was just like, people are eating outside in, you know, poisonous air.
It was shocking. Well, let's take a break. And when we come back, we will be briefly discussing the Netflix documentary, The Social Dilemma.
Tess and I watched the Netflix documentary, The Social Dilemma. And we are going to fill Emily in on it a little bit. This documentary was going kind of viral for being about a lot of the issues with social media, especially Facebook. And Tess, what did you think of The Social Dilemma?
Well, let me first say that everyone who was who had watched this movie that I know was like, it's so good. It's so important. It's going to make you deactivate everything. Like, I didn't read anything critical of it until after I tried to watch it. And then I found that I had to go find other people who didn't like it, because I hated this movie. I didn't watch the last 10 minutes because I simply could not. It was not what I expected at all. We've talked a ton on this podcast about the dangers of social media, about the dangers of being addicted to your phone, how it's so dystopian, how, you know, certain social networks especially are prone to breeding grounds for conspiracy theories that can be very dangerous, interfering with elections, all this kind of stuff. And instead of a nuanced and intelligent view of the dangers of that kind of thing, I found that this was like an after school special for people who might have thought like Facebook was good for them. You know, it was shocking to me that people liked this.
I feel like the audience for this is people who are, I guess, less informed about how social media works than we are, because it did feel very 101 in terms of like, hey, you know, they change the photos so that you'll come back more, and they change the headers because they want you to be refreshing. It's very addictive. Did you know?
Yeah. It's crazy, too, because so they're, the format of this documentary is different. It's a lot of interviews. They interview a number of former Facebook, Google, all kinds of, you know, venture capitalist people and designers and engineers who then, many of whom then moved on to work at like the Center of Humane Technology, at people who basically worked at these companies and then felt like they were complicit in some horrible unraveling of society and became kind of like whistleblowers. And
yeah,
those interviews are interesting and worth watching for sure. But then there's this whole other part of the documentary that we're dying to tell you about, Emily, because it's wild. There's a family. It's like a dramatization of how a family can be affected by social media overuse, especially the children in the family. And this is also, this leads to scenes where three different Vincent Kartizers with different hairdos are in like mission control.
Different hairlines?
Yes. And different, and like one's kind of the like more relatable Vincent Kartizer and one's the like really polished Vincent Kartizer. And they're manipulating one of the actors from the family from these dramatizations as if like they're, you know, they're like, we got to get him to get log onto Facebook right now. How are we going to do that? Like, oh, well, we'll send him a notification that his ex-girlfriend is dating someone else. And then it becomes this really melodramatic kind of thing of him becoming like a withdrawn, like he starts to look into joining fringe groups from this fake political party called like the Extreme Center or something. It's the wildest thing.
I live in the extreme center.
Tonally, it feels like a Black Mirror or something, but the overall effect is more like Reefer Madness.
Yes.
Yeah.
Like a Reefer Madness about social media. It's like, social media is bad.
I mean, that's always the knock on Black Mirror, though, right? Is that it's just like, did you know the internet is trying to kill you or something? And I think that there can be episodes of Black Mirror that are like that. But the best episodes of Black Mirror, and also just any conversation about this stuff in general, cannot stop at the idea that there is a mega corp that is trying to completely overtake your attention span. There has to be some sort of examination of how, I think, of how individuals operate within this, and like how it's kind of beyond the technology. Like some of it is like genuine social phenomenons that are like augmented by technology. And like that stuff is more interesting to me than, you know, I mean, obviously like Cambridge Analytica and stuff like that with Facebook is really bad and has like drastically impacted global politics over the last few years. I think that that's like a different story almost than how individuals get addicted to social media in different ways, because it's, I think, has a lot to do with just how human beings are and not so much with like the qualities of different platforms.
But yeah. And they deal with like the addictiveness. They use this phrase about if you don't know what the product is, that means you're the product, which I heard for the first time at the Porn Awards from a guy who worked in piracy in helping porn stars not have their work get pirated. But, you know, that was one of the knocks on like the YouTube clones for porn and anything that is like that, where you're like, oh, it's free. It's not really free. You're paying with your own personal data. But I do think, now that I'm thinking about it, I'm like, these are a lot of basic things that we know. Mm-hmm. Maybe we are just not the audience for this. Maybe the audience for this is like your grandparents,
Facebook,
that are on
moms.
Facebook.
Well, yeah. Hey, Emily, watch your tone there. I would agree with you, other than, you know, I'm not to say that everyone needs to be as deep into this and as interested in this world as we are. I think by trying to get broad appeal for something that deals with topics that I think a lot of people do find very dry. And by dramatizing like this, you know, it is obviously a lot of people are being drawn in by the premise of this, and they're being really shocked at what it's portraying. But I also kind of just disagree with documentaries doing this. You know, I mean, even if it is enlightening people that they're addicted to their phones or whatever, I think it almost kind of obscures a lot of the points that it could make. For instance, one of the Google guys, I think, is saying, like, I'm just so addicted to checking my email. I'm checking my email all the time. And it's, you know, it's like that dopamine hit. And it avoids talking about how, especially in Silicon Valley, the culture is that you need to check your email constantly. And why is that? And how do we change that and address that? So it presents these interesting ideas and then yanks you away from them to refocus you on something that's way less intriguing to me.
Yeah. And it sounds like it's treating all these things like, you know, like email, for example. It's funny to like think about them talking about an email addiction in this social media documentary, but like that it's all compartmentalized instead of part of like a larger, like you're saying, like this ties into a workplace culture, like other things can tie into like a social culture, like it's culture.
Exactly. And it's strange. I think the dramatizations bothered me so much because it doesn't present an alternative to, you know, I guess it does present the alternative. It's either that you use your phone and you're on social media, or you completely disconnect because you have to basically treat it like heroin. You know, if you take a tiny bit of like a, you know, glance at your Facebook, like you're going to be hooked because the algorithm is so advanced that it knows exactly how to keep you engaged, how to keep you engaged as long as possible.
Yeah. And you have no agency in this interaction. You are just the little, you know, point of data that's going to get whisked along into the storm.
Like, I mean, that is kind of one of the more convincing parts of it, is they're like, you know, these things are changing human behavior. They're conditioning users to behave differently. And the one of the points was just like, oh, the AI revolution is here, but this is the AI. This is the AI that controls our world.
Yeah, and they do make the point that AI is evolving faster than the human brain can. However, I mean, that's all true, but I think that the reason that this became so popular so quickly is because of quarantine, when there is no other choice to make a lot of the time if you want to interact with other human beings. And so we're all very sensitive to the fact that our engagement's gone way up. But if we disconnected entirely and we're not living in a commune or whatever, then what that means is that you are then having to, like, basically, you know, seek out alternative forms of communicating with people than those people are using. And I don't know that that's that healthy either right now, you know?
Well, this is like the whole thing with TikTok. You know, there's a lot of evidence that TikTok is just basically a personal data scraping tool and a face recognition software. And, you know, a whole generation of young people is now in this database because of this. Like, that, you know, there's a lot of evidence to suggest this. And I think a lot of people believe that. And everybody has made the calculation in their minds, like, well, that could be the case, but I want to hang out with my friends. You know, you make that calculus, whether it's right or not, like, everybody's sort of making these decisions for themselves. And that's why I'm always like a little bit like, you're not unwillingly being pulled into XYZ social network. You're making a decision because, like, for pleasure reasons, for work reasons, for efficiency reasons, you've made the choice that's, I make a lot of choices conversely in my life that are not at all time effective or anything and actively inconvenient because I want to sidestep a certain network for whatever reason. And you can do those too. But I also make a ton of decisions that totally put tons of my data on the internet. Like, you know, I'm not clean in any way, but they're all decisions at the same time. Like, I don't know.
And you can't be clean because everything is scraping your data.
Yeah.
You know, cookies are scraping your data. Just anything you do online is scraping it. So the option of completely dropping off the internet, especially right now when people are stuck at home and can't, you know, just go live their lives, it seems extremely difficult. What I really would like to happen is for new platforms to come up that are made by people that are not evil.
Yeah, I mean, there needs to be less of a monopoly for sure and more competition. And
how do we do the evil test, though? Like, realistically, like, what's the evil test on people who are running a business? I think that there's always going to be a downside to anything like this, you know?
It's just if there are more of them. I mean, for instance, I always think of Twitter as being kind of, you know, there could be an alternative to Twitter with better moderation or like more safeguards for, you know, abuse and stuff like that. It's just that there isn't, and that when things pop up, they're the only real hope that they have for being successful is to be acquired by one of the bigger companies. Mm-hmm. And so I think you don't even have to pass an evil test. You just have to like proliferate in that marketplace and give and let people say like, hey, this is a better experience for me without it being absorbed by something that can make it, you know, part of the monolith.
Yeah. And I think we've said this a lot, but maybe just going back to message boards, having things that you check less constantly that have more moderation so that there are just like downtimes between reading Twitter all day.
Yeah. I mean, again, we talked about this on our bonus episode, but like we have to remember too, like Twitter is niche. Like Twitter is not Facebook in the level of like people who are on it and people who are interacting. It's big, you know, it's certainly a big service, but it's not, it already is an alt to something, which is Facebook. You know, I do agree, like we should have more choices as far as that goes, but like we already, I don't know. I don't have total faith in the idea that like just more like, you know, we need more LOs in the world and then we'll eventually like land on something virtuous. I don't think that that's the case.
I just wonder. I mean, it's when you think about how powerful these companies are. And again, like, I've always wanted to find something that offers like, you know, certain things that Facebook offers, but is not Facebook. And there have been things proposed from like the Wikipedia had an offshoot and Elo, and it's just the migration doesn't happen. And it just never becomes anything. But I do wonder, like, you know, if you're on Facebook for one particular group, and you see that a lot in like really active groups, like podcast fan groups or parenting groups or whatever, where people say, I'm only on here for this. If that group could splinter off onto like a different site that had different, a whole different way of operating, would that be enough to draw those people away from Facebook? Like for me, it would be, you know?
Right. If you just went to like a listserv or something. Like,
yeah.
Yeah. No, totally. I think, and that's the thing, like a lot of people don't realize that those options are out there for them, or they don't like, it just takes a kind of critical mass of people to be like, hey, we're going to move this chess enthusiast group to a Yahoo listserv and it'll be fine. And then you'll need to check Facebook like one third as much as you do now, you know, like, or not at all. I think that people can make these decisions for themselves. We are now joined by Justin Charity. Justin Charity is a writer at The Ringer. He is the co-host of Sound Only on The Ringer Network. Great podcast. Highly recommend it. Hi, Justin. What's up?
Hello. Oh, my God. This is exciting. I'm starstruck by all of you.
I feel like we've been trying to get you on Night Call forever. I feel like if there was going to be a Justin Charity episode of Night Call, like, you know, we just have to prepare the world. Like, it might get too hot. So we were just talking about The Social Network, and not that this is the main reason that we wanted to have you on the podcast. There's plenty of other stuff to talk about, but, and I'm sure that you're sick of being bugged about this, but you are one of my friends who is not on any social media at all anymore. You took the vow of chastity.
The vow of chastity. Yes.
When did you do this?
You know what it is? I don't remember when specifically. It was vaguely around the time of whenever Kanye was releasing Ye.
Wow.
I just remember that. I remember like that was the last phase of Twitter discourse I was around for, was the Ye discourse.
Was that the last straw?
You know, I didn't have that many strong opinions about Ye, if I remember correctly.
Right. Was it more about the fandom surrounding Ye and the...
No, it wasn't about Kanye. It was just sort of anticlimactic. I think by that point, it was probably several other things.
Yeah.
And the Ye discourse was just sort of like the epilogue of my time on social media.
It is a pretty like intense concentration of a lot of things that are wrong with how, especially like art and celebrity gets discussed online, like anything having to do with Kanye can get, you know, just to 100 real quick. I didn't even like, I was kind of tuned out for the Ye discourse, I have to say. I think there was something in my brain that just like flagged it. It was like, this is exhausting. I'm not going to engage with this. And then I realized, I think I had assumed you were still on Instagram or something, because you used to do all sorts of like baked good stuff and cooking on Instagram, which was always great. And then I realized you weren't even on Instagram anymore. I was like, dang, you went all the way. Oh my God.
I'm like dramatic. That's the problem, is that I'm dramatic, right? So I had to be like, and another thing, because I deleted Facebook and I deleted Instagram. I think I deleted something else I can't even remember.
Did you delete them all at once? Were you like, one day, that's it?
Yeah, in 1 week. And then they do the thing where they try to sweat you out. So they're like, listen, your account will be around for a month, just in case you want to. It's like the worst the breakup Facebook ever.
Yeah. That's the one that I really, that's the only one I've totally unplugged from.
Yeah.
I'm sorry I cut you off, but just to go back to what you were saying a second ago, you're on Reddit now, or did you like, you segued to Reddit for
a
bit?
No, I didn't. I joined Reddit maybe like a year after I left Twitter. Because I'd never understood Reddit. Like back during the, I remember, it felt like a decade ago where people were really, really hyping Reddit and trying to explain Reddit to me, and it always, my eyes glazed over. And I think I just got into this, oh, you know what it was? It's the amateur boxing subreddit that I sort of like followed enough that I was like, I should just make an account. Like I actually like the structure of conversations on Reddit, even if there are plenty of reasons not to like particular subreddits. Mm-hmm. Something about the conversational structure and the anonymity structure of Reddit feels a bit healthier to me, even though I know that healthy is not exactly Reddit's reputation.
I love Reddit.
It's a message board.
Exactly. Yeah. And that's why I'm like, why am I not more into Reddit? Like, that's the context of internet conversation I grew up with and feel most comfortable with. I have a Reddit account, I guess. I've never posted on it. And I mostly just lurk on a few different subreddits. But
Tess, aren't you a big Reddit lurker?
I'm a giant Reddit lurker. I lurk on Reddit for like, I set aside about an hour every evening for my Reddit lurking.
Yes. Teach me how to Reddit, because I still feel like I don't do it right.
Because
I lurk too. You know what I mean? I've maybe posted on Reddit 5 times ever.
I've only posted, I think, twice, but I find it less addictive and less like social media when I pick two, or I don't have like a curated homepage even. I just pick 2 or 3 boards that I like. And one, I mean, they're both pretty popular. The legal advice and the Am I the Asshole are my two mains.
Am I the Asshole often, that gets viral enough that it spreads to other other networks.
Corners of the internet. Legal advice is my favorite forever. I've talked about it on the podcast before, just because it there was this one post about bats that I got in trouble for, because there was like a ton of misinformation. It was an abandoned house that had a bat problem and it was going to be condemned, and there were a bunch of questions about that. And then in the comments, people were like fear-mongering about bats, and then we had a few bat defenders call into the pod and be like, Tess, don't get your information from Reddit. And I didn't listen. I still do.
I follow the Bats Every Hour Twitter account. It's one of the main things keeping me on Twitter, is these accounts that post a picture of a bat. There's one that does a bat, one that does a rat, and one that does a cat.
No, I can't.
There's also a possum.
Yes, but the Bats Every Hour, it's like they also are pro-bat activists. So they have a lot of bat facts that are like, bats don't actually give you rabies. People think they do. And like, vampire bats only eat like a teaspoon of blood, and it's from cows.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. No need to fear bats. It's like bat PR.
You're right.
It's like Katie Golden's bird activist, birds rights activist, except for real.
Bats got a bad rap this year. We got to come rep for the bats.
We got bats here. It's pretty cool. Yeah, I feel like that's the thing, though. Like you were talking about, like, those sorts of accounts keep you on Twitter. And I feel like that's a big key difference with like Twitter versus a Reddit or something. Like when I'm on Reddit, I'm usually specifically looking to find out about one topic, and I can really hone in on it and then get lost in a 300 post long thread and just read every single thing. The one I'm thinking of most recently is Terrace House, that I had that kind of relationship to a Reddit, where it's like, like, you know, anytime a new episode, I would watch a new episode, then I would go and read the mega thread for that episode and just read every single person's opinions about it, which felt very cozy. It felt like, I don't know, back in the old days on like TV Without Pity or something. Shout out to Tara Ariano. Like, I used to just go and read thousands and thousands of posts about like Battlestar Galactica episodes and stuff. And that was my internet. And there is something kind of nice and chill about that with Reddit. And you're not going to accidentally run into other information that gets you off track or angry about something else or something. You're like there to read about this one thing. Yeah. Well, Justin, you are so Sound Only, which originally started as an Ava podcast for yes. when Ava first went on Netflix. You and Micah Peters did. It wasn't like a recap. It was like you guys go deep. Like a recap doesn't do it justice, I feel like.
Well, especially because we didn't do per episode, right? We sort of clustered the episodes into batches of six, specifically to avoid it being too like beat for beat recappy.
Right. Which is easy to do, I imagine. But yeah.
Yeah. And then we just yelled for 4 hours at a time about Neon Genesis Evangelion. And it was great. And I lost my voice by episode two. Unfortunately. It was great. It was ecstatic.
I have to say, having edited you on podcasts, because you came on a couple times on my short-lived anime podcast back in the day, like, you have a great podcast voice, but like there are peaks, like I have to edit around the peaks.
So you can't get straight in this.
But yeah, but then you guys brought it back recently. How many weeks now have you been back for Sound Only?
Six. I think we're on episode six. We talked about Travis Scott this past week. That's the thing. It's not an anime podcast now, and that's sort of the pitch is that this is not an anime podcast. Then we're sort of
You had one you had like your first real anime episode, and I feel like it was like 4 weeks in or something like that. So totally. It's diffuse. It's like rap, internet, anime, all that. So
millennial shit.
Did you talk about the Travis Scott burger?
Yes. Mm. Yes. And the merch. Okay. Did any of you buy the Travis Scott merchandise? Because I seriously considered it, and I'm 33, so let's talk about this. Because
I did just listen to that episode, and Micah was clowning on you big time for getting the shorts. I believe
no, it was I wanted the to. They sold out. I wanted to get So Travis Scott was selling what they're like $70 gym shorts, and there's a red pair, and they look like they're just extremely mid 90s, sort of over designed. And I could have bought them because I spend time in McCarran Park, you know, in Brooklyn. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I do jump squats. I could do some jump squats in those shorts, you know. It could have worked for me. And then they sold out within the day. And then all the other merch is not good. Like, Travis Scott is one of those rappers who has that kind of way too busy millennial rapper aesthetic. And there's exactly one article of clothing of that whole merch bundle from McDonald's that I thought I could pull this off. And then the rest of it is like, come on, dog. I pay taxes. I'm too old for this.
Okay, but did you have the burger?
No. And that's the thing. Like, I go to McDonald's maybe like once every other year. And like, it's not time. You know what I mean? I operate like an animal. Like, it's not time for me to do my McDonald's pilgrimage.
Even if Cactus Jack sends you, you're not going to go.
No, I don't know. I'm just not in the mood.
May I ask what this burger was? Because I'm out of the loop.
Explain that.
What's on the burger now?
It's
just
a quarter pounder with bacon on it.
It's just like a burger they already have on the menu. It's so funny. It's just like the Travis Scott burger. It's just like a bacon cheeseburger.
It's a whole, because you have the fries, but then you get barbecue sauce for the fries.
Yeah, that's it. And that's it. And it's funny because the commercial for it is so, it really wants you to be impressed, counter to what Molly just said. It really wants, it's like pitching you on the idea of a hamburger like you've never heard of it. So it's like,
check
you know,
this out.
What if you went to McDonald's and you got a sandwich and this in some bread, but then there's meat and then there's sauce on it? Wouldn't that be nice? Tell them Travis sent you. It's like, wait a minute. Am I being sold something I already have is how I feel about.
That's what's so funny about it to me is that it's so like postmodern. It's like, you're ordering what Travis Scott orders at McDonald's exactly. It's not like a special burger they made for him. It's like, this is what Cactus Jack orders when he goes to McDonald's, and you can go and do it too. I feel like Kanye was gonna do that Gap promotion where he was gonna like make a bunch of khakis and sell them, you know, cargo pants, and like sell us cargo pants. And then Travis Scott like leapt ahead of him in normcore by being like,
yeah,
I've branded a regular burger.
I'm gonna fucking put golden arches on merch, like, and you're gonna buy it. You're gonna pay top dollar for it. It's a move.
But Micah noted, that it's way more likely that I would buy those shorts, those $70 shorts, than it was that I would buy the actual burger itself, which itself feels like a drag of me in some way that I haven't really even unpacked yet.
I don't think it is. I think that, I mean, what is it? I would love to just like camp out and watch like at a McDonald's and see what it looks like if somebody does come in to order the Travis Scott meal. Like, how do you ask for it? Like, what do you say? And are you embarrassed when you do that? Or are you like, no, this is cool. Like, are you impressed with my order?
I think all the people, especially all of the all the Zoomers who do it, they're going to be like every Zoomer I've ever interacted with in Rainbow Six Siege team voice chat. You know what I mean? Like, they're all the sort of, I worry that there's just going to be this onslaught of suburban kids wearing the worst clothes you can imagine, sort of with really over elaborate slang, really, really, really selling the bit to the cashier at McDonald's who was just so profoundly irritated with the number of people whom Cactus Jack has sent.
I saw a TikTok of somebody ordering it that was really funny, where it was like they were filming it. I think a lot of people will probably film themselves ordering the burger. But it was like this teenager, and he goes in without a mask, and he's like, Cactus Jack sent me. And then the cashier is like, you have to wear a mask. Here's a mask for you, and put it on. And he's like, Cactus Jack sent me. And they're like, what? He's like, give me the Travis Scott burger. And then this woman in line, who's like a Karen, starts just like going off at him and being like, what's wrong with you? You sound like a fucking dork. And she like chases him and his friends out of McDonald's. And she's like, you're such a fucking dweeb.
That's actually like really
That's not Karen,
sharp.
That's me.
That's a good Karen. Like, I mean, whatever. I don't care about kids ordering the Travis Scott meal at McDonald's, but that's actually like a funny, like,
you're a dweeb. Get the fuck out of here.
It was so funny, especially because she kind of looks like from behind, she's wearing like yoga pants and a tie-dye sweatshirt. And then she turns around and it's like a different type of woman than you expect. And she's just like, what are you doing? Why are you filming in here? Like, what the fuck is wrong
with
you?
What's a TikTok?
She doesn't fuck with Travis Scott. I mean, a lot of people don't, you know, there's a backlash.
Yeah. So I wanted to talk to you specifically because you are an anime friend and you talk about anime on your podcast. And I'm pretty sure you won't talk about this on your podcast anytime soon just because it's old and there's no real reason to talk about it. But I started watching Psycho Pass this past week, which we can explain for Molly and Tess, but is kind of like, it's actually too much of a night call show. It's almost like too on the nose. I feel like a lot of the episodes that I'm watching, it's just like, this is just like the exact stuff that we talk about every week. Yeah. It almost makes me feel like, like a little bit self-conscious. It's like, they've already covered this ground, like all the stuff about like avatars and stuff and in some of the early episodes. But it is a show that I started watching because of the Halo, which we discussed a couple weeks back, the Amazon Halo, that is like it's a fitness tracker or like physical activity tracker that also is supposed to, the claims to be able to track your tone and your mood and, you know, I guess for your own elucidation about yourself, but then who knows, you know, what that data could actually be used for. And the concept of Psycho Pass, and you can fill in anything that I forget, is that this happens in like a near future where everybody has this thing called a Psycho Pass, which is their level of like their crime coefficient. So it's sort of like Minority Report. It's like a pre-crime type thing, but it's basically like based on your psychological state, your emotional state, and, you know, whatever level of trauma that you've been through and haven't been like gone through therapy for, like how likely you are to be a violent criminal or just like any kind of criminal, I guess. And then based on that, like this police force can they have these weapons that specifically only shoot people who have a high enough crime coefficient. So it's like super, super dystopian. Like there's a little bit like I feel like Watchmen did something kind of like that in its first episode where there's like a gun that you have to have like permission to use. So it's like supposed to be this utopia, this utopian world that this show takes place in. But of course, it's all super, super dystopian because there's just this idea of like this system that tracks your emotional instability and thus your likelihood to do a crime. You've watched this, like, this is old. This is like from 2011 or something.
Yeah, I watched the first season, like back maybe a few years after it first aired, the first season.
Yeah.
Wait, what made you want to go back to just the, had you been meaning to watch
it? I've been meaning to watch it for a while because Eric Thurm, our mutual friend, is a big fan of it. And I was really into and am really into Madoka Magica, which is the same writer. That's like a dark magical girl anime, and Psychopass is more like a noir thriller type thing. But they're kind of about the same stuff. They end up kind of existing in similar territory. Yeah, it made me think about just like, I mean, you guys talked on a recent episode just about like getting the, you know, I mean, no, it wasn't an episode. I think you and I were just talking about like getting into an anime, like half of it is just like buying into a concept like that, like a sci-fi conceit a lot of times.
Yeah, yeah. And it being a conceit that is just, I don't know. Unlike a lot of other media, I feel like anime shows don't even really bother to do that much upselling of the concept. It's just like you really, by episode one, have to be prepared to put up with some dumb shit. And it right. And a lot of times it works and a lot of times it doesn't. And Psychopass is just something that I remember the first episode of Psychopass feeling so, I don't know. I think that concept, that show just gets over the top. I remember Psychopass feeling like it gets really over the top about its otherwise, like, you feel like you should be watching a procedural, but it's so much.
Yeah. It goes to, like, the worst case scenario of every single corner of society really, yeah, really fast. Like, somebody who, like, works ungodly hours at a drone factory and then like goes crazy and kills people at the drone factory by programming the drones to kill them. And like, it's just all like ticking every single box of like society.
Yeah, that's, yeah. To your point about concepts though, it's like, it's hard to go from watching something like Psychopass to watching, I don't know, if you went and watched a season of Sherlock, you'd be like, really? This is all you got? I just watched Psychopass.
Right. you know? You don't go hard enough.
Yeah.
Yeah. Is there anything recently? I know you've been super into Black Lagoon, but any shows you've been into more recently?
I mean, that's the thing. I watch TV so sporadically, and this is true of even just like my anime consumption. I go through weird, not weird, I think a lot of people do this, but I otherwise don't watch a lot of television except when I get to those seasons where it's just like, I'm going to watch 8 anime series for no reason.
Mm-hmm.
And they're all going to be from the mid-2000s through, you know, the past decade. And like when
Silver
I first
Age.
Watched Psychopass. Yeah, the Silver Age. Like I first watched Psychopass and Ergo Proxy, which is also feels like a Night Call show. Ergo Proxy is...
I've never watched Ergo Proxy, you know.
What's the deal?
I don't even remember. It's one of those shows where everything feels sort of like techie and dystopian. And it's like one thing that's sort of weird about the show is that Paranoid Android is the end credits music for it.
Ah.
And I remember not liking Ergo Proxy when I first saw it, but it also has a vibe to it. And it's like, yeah, the perfect kind of binge watching vibe where it's, you don't really feel like putting up with an anime premise so much as you feel like just sort of letting yourself wallow in,
yes,
a certain aesthetic.
Yeah. A certain musical, like, color, yeah, moodiness aesthetic sometimes.
Yeah.
Or just something really, like, soft and cute sometimes. You just want to be in, like, a cutie show for a while, a rom-com.
Totally. Black Lagoon is different. Black Lagoon is so, it's like mid-aughts anime action, and it has, frankly, like really good race comedy. It's the main thing that I like about it. Because, I don't know, it's like anime and Japanese video games sometimes have such a weird, stilted conception of race when they're working with, like, American characters especially. But I really like how Black Lagoon has a really good neo-Nazi arc where it's just, like, the characters are fighting neo-Nazis on a boat.
Okay.
And it's just really good. And the show has a lot of stuff like that where it's actually surprisingly effectively multicultural in a way that has edge to it, but not in an ill-intentioned way that edge usually, you know what I mean? It sort of feels like a gritty We Are the World like vibe to it in a way.
Yeah, like it's picking up like the right stuff from more global action entertainment or genre entertainment or something.
Doesn't watching really dystopian stuff make you want to curl up in a ball though?
I don't know. I don't think so. There can be something kind of comforting about some stuff. And I think there is something about when it is in the medium of animation that makes it kind of go down easier. I'm not always going to be in the mood for like, I mean, I still have never finished watching The Leftovers. Like that just got so dark for me that it was just like not fun to watch. I understand that it gets really amazing in later seasons, but it was such a bummer. I was like, why am I doing this to myself? I had that thought at certain points in Mad Men. There's something about anime where it's like, there could be like grievous bodily harm. Okay, but we're talking about this more as like an idea than like me putting myself through this as a piece of entertainment. So it like doesn't, I mean, it's obviously like can be troubling and upsetting at times, but it just is like a different kind of experience. I don't know. How would you qualify that? I don't know how to describe that exactly, that difference.
To me, it's usually actually something about performances in anime that usually help. Psychopaths especially, I just remember feeling like some of the performances feel strangely disconnected from what you're watching. And I don't know, there's so many levels at which anime is like reminding you not to take it too seriously, unless it's a kind of show that really wants to be taken that seriously, I guess, right? But yeah, something like Psychopaths is like a good encapsulation of that, right? Where its premise feels super convoluted and self-serious, but at the same time, its execution just feels so patently absurd that you're never gonna feel that oppressed by it.
Yeah, it's like a thinker, not necessarily like, I'm gonna take this, whatever idea this show is trying to get across and apply it directly to my life or anything. It's more like, it's a take. It's like, let's take an absurd premise, drive it all the way to its logical endpoint, and do it with the most like melodrama and, you know, just like it's just like emo performances in every sense of the word from every character. Like everything is just way dialed up.
But I think the other thing that does a lot of favors to anime series, like something like Psychopaths, for instance, has multiple, I think it has three seasons. But in general, it's sort of stuff that's not, you know, 500 seasons, stuff like Dragon Ball, right? Like it's not that uncommon for an anime, for something that's popular to get a single season and for the story of it to be something that needs to be sort of open and shut in a single season. And I think that creates this dynamic where a lot of series feel like it's the people working on it getting every idea they've ever had about this premise out and leaving sort of nothing on the field. I think that's the thing, too.
It's just,
there's so much of a sense of YOLO to a lot of these sort of high concept shows that it feels like it's harder to get out of live action television sometimes when it's sort of the vibe of live action television is that, oh, you're driving towards some sort of seasonal cliffhanger and then the momentum of this is sort of indefinite, as opposed to an anime series that's like 1 to 3 seasons and you're just sort of like, we're going to exhaust this concept.
Yeah. There's not this sense of like, it's not like a same, I guess it's just like a completely different system of like pitching stuff to networks or studios or whatever. Like you don't have to necessarily come in with this idea of what happens in the sixth season when you're pitching an anime, I don't imagine. I mean, I don't know that much about it, but like it doesn't seem like it's kind of coming out of that same sort of logic where it's like, okay, walk us through the third season. Like, you know, you have to know the fates of all these characters in the first season. Like, I don't know. I've talked to a lot of people about how that can be really frustrating, you know, within the American television system. And I feel like that's one thing that maybe creatively is like, I don't know, more open-ended or less like structured or rigorous or something about Japanese animation. I don't know.
I feel like also just like British television shows that will do like just a one-off.
Yeah.
In America.
Yeah. It's like the similar idea. It's like what's a good idea? Let's do it. It's kind of the inverse because in that case, it's just like, this is a 6-episode idea. Like, that's all that we need to communicate this.
Sometimes it's a 6-episode idea. Sometimes it doesn't have to be a 10-season idea. You can really just like get what you're going for. And if it's a really high concept thing, especially, it's like maybe you exhausted in one season.
Yeah. What's the last show non-animated that you got into over lockdown?
Over lockdown? I don't know that I've watched any. Oh, you know what? I just rewatched a ton of Grey's with my girlfriend. That's the only live action TV.
Grey's Anatomy?
Which I loved in college. I fucking loved Grey's Anatomy. And I loved it as much upon revisiting Grey's Anatomy from the beginning of the show.
I loved how you called it Grey's to show you familiar.
Insiders know.
Oh my.
That's great. Yeah. I have a hard time watching stuff in lockdown too. Like, I feel like the dominant sort of assumption has been like, oh, there's nothing to do, so you're just going to watch every TV show or go through entire series that are like, you know, 8 seasons long or something. I think I started off lockdown being too anxious to like sit still through anything. And even still now, this is a bad habit that I don't like. Like, I try to be more strict with myself about this, but now just because like everything is crazy, I don't care as much. I have to have my phone or something else to do while I'm watching something. And I used to just be eyes on the screen, experience the cinematic event or whatever. And now I'm just like doing like I'll go in and out. I'll go to the bathroom without pausing it. You know, I'm just very inattentive now, I feel like.
I thought I was going to be super into, because I play video games, and I thought that at the start of all of this, of like lockdowns and whatnot, that I just sort of assumed like, oh, I'm going to play so many video games. I can tell I'm going to lose so much time to this. And I haven't. I don't have the appetite for it. And I don't even know why. Like it's like the assumptions I had about what my media consumption would be like in the work from home tyranny have just been wrong. Like, I started baking a lot, then I started learning some programming, but I have not gamed a ton or anything like that, which is...
Oh my God, we have to talk about the programming.
Programming is fun.
Justin's a coder now. Justin learned to code.
I did. And it's like, I actually do, like, contrary to what we were saying before, I have a Twitter account now because I needed, you need a Twitter account to have access to the Twitter API.
The API, yeah.
And so, like, I was writing this, I've been writing some small programs to, like, well, I had been writing some programs to comb Twitter for tweets about QAnon, or basically, comb the QAnon hashtag for tweets. And I ended up like with this spreadsheet of 30,000 QAnon tweets. And so now I'm doing like all of this stuff where I'm trying to like data mine it. And this is all just like as an exercise, but it is also kind of funny, like staring at 33,000 QAnon tweets in a spreadsheet and seeing like rhetorical patterns in the actual tweets and in people's profiles and stuff like that. And the sort of distinction between the people who are tweeting in the hashtag sincerely versus the people who are like, this is awful. Like, we have to put an end to QAnon. These are the worst people.
What's the ratio of like sincere QAnoners to QAnon critics when you look at it?
I don't know yet. I haven't analyzed it yet. I spent a lot of time sort of generating different searches to tweak the kind of results that I was getting. I don't know. I'll let you know next week.
Yeah, I want to know.
Time this weekend, yeah.
I'm bringing up this screenshot that you sent me of the scraped tweets, I guess. It's like, it's really hard to tell. Like, I mean, I think like a lot of this stuff is like, do you also get people's like profiles from this. Their bios.
Yeah, their bios.
Like everybody who says like family, God, country, constitution. Well,
that's the main thing at a glance that's super obvious before I even like start parsing it, right? Is that a lot of evangelical shit is, and it's funny, there's like a New York Times story from yesterday. That's an author who is writing about this, a sort of connection between evangelicals and QAnon. But it's so super obvious when you start looking through the profiles of a lot of QAnon people that the people who don't just have this sort of trust the plan, you know, QAnon sloganeering, the explicit QAnon sloganeering, they otherwise mostly tend to have like Christian evangelical signaling.
Mm-hmm.
Although I have noticed a lot of wellness-oriented white ladies getting into QAnon over the past month or so, especially. It's gotten really crazy.
Wait, really?
Yep.
Yeah. And then somebody sent us a message. I think she might leave a call about it, but a lot of like Facebook mom, you know, natural mom message boards, they go along this path from like, you know, anti-vaxxing to 5G conspiracies to QAnon.
Save the children.
Right.
And save the children.
The save the children thing, because then people start getting in arguments being like, what, do you not want me to save the children?
A lot of time recently, actually, in the past couple of weeks, I still am in mom groups on Facebook, which I would like to not be on anymore, but I am. And one of the top suggested pages of like one of the bigger mom groups has been a Trump page. And it says like similar topics, you know, topics similar to the one, the group that you're in.
Oh, my God.
And
weird.
Because it's like an LA local moms group, we're mostly liberal, but there is a small portion of the people who are in that group that are, like Molly said, it starts off with being like, I'm not an anti-vaxxer. I just think we should be asking questions. Mm-hmm. And then it gets more into like a defensive, like, I don't like the term anti-vaxxer, but I'm not vaccinating. Then it goes to 5G. And then it falls off a cliff. And I think there are a lot of moms in particular, and probably other parents as well, but who are like kind of private about those things when they talk to you in person. But on their Facebook pages, on their social media, they're pretty public about QAnon stuff, which has been interesting in terms of like school board dynamics and stuff like that when that becomes more public.
Somebody sent me some crazy photos from a QAnon Save the Children rally in Santa Monica.
In Santa Monica. There was one in Hollywood, too, not that long ago.
Yeah, this one in Santa Monica, it was just like, it looked like midsummer. Mm-hmm. It was like all these white women wearing like white dresses, linens, like standing on the beach with these like Save the Children signs. It was the creepiest thing I've ever seen.
Yeah, oh, it's alarming.
I hate that this kind of misinformation dynamic too is the, it feels like the definitive problem of like the age, right? And it sort of feels like it paints people who are like naturally aghast at that stuff into this corner of being sort of ridiculed as like wanting to censor everybody. But it's like, what is the actual, you know what I mean? It's sort of, it feels like nothing about our politics is conducive to figuring out what to do about those people. You know what I mean?
I mean, I've been working on a podcast episode for one of my other podcasts about the protocols of the Elders of Zion and just how that disseminated as a conspiracy theory in the early 20th century. And it kind of makes me feel like a lot of the things we say about that it has to be this moment that makes people be like this. It's like, no, people have always been like this. Even when things get debunked, that makes some people double down and be like, oh, well, they want us to think it's fake. And that's, you know, we know it's not really fake.
I think I mean more like the tools of dissemination, though, right? I think the thing that makes it feel like such a palpable political anxiety is just the fact that it's so in your, because these platforms have so many of us on them, because they're these 24/7 generators of content, there's just something that feels like it's being thrown in your face constantly about the fact that these people want to save the children.
Yeah. And like disagreement or dissent is the only thing that can justify like staying on these platforms a lot of times, especially with Twitter. So there has to be some sort of element of something that you're pushing against, whether that is, you know, the standard narrative that QAnon is not real or to, you know, that you should get your kids vaccinated. Like if you don't have some, like it's basically like we're working our way down the list of like things that are fairly common sense and kind of whatabouting them in some way. Like there will always be a community that is going to try to poke holes in something that everybody takes for granted. And that like can often just look like conspiracy theories, but it's just like this act of contrarianism, basically, kind of for its own sake, because otherwise, what are you going to talk about? Yeah. And it just feels like it's like the kind of thing of if you're in a conversation that you don't know how to end with somebody, and then you just keep bringing up stuff that you didn't actually want to talk about. It feels like that sometimes.
That's actually like a very vivid way of putting that, I think.
Right. Well, yeah, as long as you're on Twitter, it's like you can only post nice things about stuff that you enjoy for so long before it's like, okay, what am I fighting against now here? Which is like good and bad. That's the good and bad thing about that platform specifically. We talk about all this stuff a lot, I feel like, but
I've always thought that like, you remember the I want to say first wave sort of social media coverage where it was like you would see those pieces, right, where it'd be, I don't know, a Slate columnist being like, I left Twitter for 3 days, here's what I learned in the wilderness, right? And everyone would be like, he quit Twitter for 3 days, right? And I always felt like those pieces were kind of silly and people made fun of them. But I feel like an assumption that was always embedded in those pieces was that the problem with Twitter was that the problem with Twitter is other people, right? The problem with Twitter is that people say things you don't like. And the idea is that it's a hell site because of other people. When I think actually, like, I love reading Twitter. The thing I dislike and the thing I distrust and the thing that I think needs to be stamped out about Twitter is one's own impulse to post.
Yes.
Right? That's the actual problem. Like, the best version of Twitter would be the best version for a person, for me at least, of Twitter is one in which you can, if you want to see somebody's tweet, right? If you want to see what somebody's saying about something, you can find it. But you're liberated from the ability and thus the impulse to post.
Yeah.
I think that's the actual bad thing.
Yeah. It's like the faux feeling of responsibility that if you're not posting, then you're not participating in a meaningful way, both on the platform and in the world in general. And that is like this completely fake dynamic that site and the way of communicating creates. I mean, it seems like you found the perfect solution, which is to not be on Twitter, but to create codes to scrape QAnon Twitter.
To just read thousands of QAnon tweets. That's really what the ideal social media diet is. 33,000 QAnon tweets.
Oh my God.
You were like, I want to go right to the part where I feel crazy.
But that's the entirety of it. You can just get that super concentrated espresso shot of QAnon. Yeah. The cold brew. Like,
give me that Travis Scott burger of the mind.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
Don't forget the Sprite. That's the most insulting thing about the Travis Scott commercial, by the way, is that he's like, and by the way, just so you know, the coup de grace, the thing that really makes this reflective of me, my personality and brand and ethos is that you have to be sure to drink a Sprite with this meal.
It's a good Sprite. It is the best Sprite, the McDonald's Sprite.
I can't even. It's been so long.
Sprite is a crazy taste.
Yeah.
To me.
Yeah.
Dog, I haven't had Sprite since like 1998, to be honest.
I had a sip of Sprite the other day and was like, what is this?
Because
if you go too long, like the idea of Sprite and the reality of Sprites are really
lemon lime.
Disjointed. Yeah.
Yeah.
Disjointed. Wait, say more about this, the disjointed nature.
It tastes like battery acid in a way, you know, because if your kind of idea of like, the citrus soda was formed on Sprite, and then a long time passes and you're drinking like actual like lemonade, for instance, and then you reintroduce Sprite, you're like, this is not citrus, this is like acid. I don't drink a lot of soda, but the Sprite, like, I'll have a root beer or a Coke or whatever and be like, this is fine with me, but the Sprite was a bridge too far.
I'd rather have a Surge than a Sprite.
Ooh. I like how sodas taste like battery acid. That's what I like about them. That's also what I like about grapefruit juice.
I mean, Ting, for instance, like a grapefruit soda I can deal with because it's closer to the flavor of the fruit than a Sprite is close to the lemon lime, personally.
Yeah.
I mean, lemon lime is like a muddled flavor anyway. Grapefruit's very specific.
Yeah. Lemon lime is completely abstracted by Sprite. Like when you actually have something that's lemon lime, it's a completely different thing. Like sweet and sour mix or something in a bar. It's like, that's lemon lime. And it doesn't taste anything like Sprite.
Well, yeah. Come on, guys. Because Sprite is a simulacra.
Exactly.
I knew that's where this was going.
Exactly. That's what we were building.
I listened to this podcast enough to know that that's where this was going.
Well, thank you, Justin, for joining us. Normally, we ask where people can find you, but we've established pretty strongly that nobody can find you anywhere.
Nowhere.
Except at theringer.com.
I'm Elaine. I exist in the Wired. And yeah.
Omnipresent in the Wired. And you are, as we mentioned, on Sound Only, on the Ringer Network, on wherever one gets their podcasts.
Yep.
Anything else?
No, that's it. Thanks. This is fun.
Thank you so much, Justin.
Tell them Travis. Definitely. Tell them Travis Jackson.
Come back sometime, you know, you can be part of the Night Call anime.
Yes, inevitable.
And thank you for listening to Night Call. You can subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your shows. You can also follow us on social media. We are on Twitter at Night Call Pod, Instagram and Facebook at Night Call Podcast. You can support us on Patreon at patreon.com/nightcall, where you can get our bonus episodes, our monthly newsletter, our playlists, and all of that fun stuff. And give us a night call. 1-240-46-NIGHT. Leave your thoughts, concerns, conspiracy theories. We're always looking for new ones. And we'll see you all next week.